Cairns, and I'm the president of the Vancouver Institute for this year. And it's my role to introduce the speaker, but it's also my role to delay that introduction so that I can make a few announcements and draw a few phenomena to your attention. First of all, I'd like to remind you of the next two lectures. Next week, 1 week tonight, Professor Fritjof Bergmann will give the J.V. Klein lecture on, quote, the future of work, the future of culture, unquote. And then in 2 weeks, on October 29th, Professor David Owen Norris of the Royal Academy of Music, London, will speak on the craft of music. So, as you can see from these two anticipations of what awaits you on successive Saturday nights, and there is more that is exciting to follow, your executive has worked diligently and successfully to provide you with interesting ways to spend your Saturday evenings. Our speakers, as you probably know, are unpaid, and most of the work is done by volunteers. Nevertheless, there are some costs attached to running the Vancouver Institute, and this is where you come in. So we invite you to join. Joining is both a symbolic act and a practical act, since you will have to reach into your wallet, but the membership fees are very low. It's $5 for a student, $15 for a single non-student individual, and $25 for a family. And we very shrewdly have left on the form that you will fill out when you unfailingly join, as I know you will after this evening is finished, there is a space on the form for a supplementary donation. You can conveniently make your contribution and join the Institute as you leave at the table on the side of the corridor going out on my right. And if you do this, this will have two important benefits for you. First of all, you will get a receipt for a charitable donation, both for the membership fees and for any supplementary contribution you make. And secondly, and maybe more important, if you go to church tomorrow, you can look the minister in the eye with your still warm memory of a good deed done only a few hours earlier. Now to our speaker. Dr. Jeffrey Weller has lectured on most continents, is very widely published, and has made innumerable speeches to community groups. He is the founding president and a professor of political science at the University of Northern British Columbia in Prince George. He began his academic career teaching at Bishop's University and was vice president academic of Lakehead University before assuming his current position as president of the new University of Northern British Columbia in January 1991. He has written numerous scholarly articles. He saves space on his CV by simply identifying the numbers he has written rather than listing them, and the numbers are very impressive. Written numerous scholarly articles in such fields as health policy, security and intelligence, and as I've already indicated, he's lectured extensively literally around the world. As a political scientist, Jeffrey Weller is, as all political scientists am, I am a political scientist, a keen student of politics. However, as a university president, he is also, I expect, a keen and successful practitioner of politics. As I look at my political science colleagues around the country, I view this as a very rare combination. And this rare combination, I think, uniquely qualifies our speaker to address his subject, which is the future of the Canadian intelligence services in the post-Cold War world. Dr. Jeffrey Weller. I guess that should be okay. I think it might fell off on me.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everybody. In this presentation, I shall begin by talking a little bit about some of the common misperceptions that appear in discussions of matters related to security and intelligence. I shall then indicate how intelligence agencies have grown since the end of the Second World War and become an integral part of the bureaucracies and policy processes of most nations, including Canada. I shall then follow this with a general discussion of the scope of what can be referred to as the Canadian Intelligence Network. I shall then argue that the network is not likely to shrink very much in size and budget as a result of the end of the Cold War. That is, there is unlikely to be much of a peace dividend. I shall argue that there is more likely to be a major reorientation of the network to combat new threats. I shall then review the major new threats that are emerging and argue, unfortunately, that those threats are real and need addressing. I shall conclude by arguing that although the reorientation does open up the possibility of Canada increasingly moving towards a surveillance state, that this is unlikely to happen, given the ethos of the services involved and the controls that are in place on at least a part of the Canadian intelligence network. Until recently, there's been very little by way of scholarly study and analysis of intelligence agencies. Most people's views of intelligence agencies have been molded by spy films and spy fiction and the memoirs of intelligence agency veterans. No doubt all of you have read at some time the novels of John Buchan and Graham Greene, Eric Ambler, John le Carré, Len Dayton, and of course Ian Fleming of James Bond fame. However, very few people know that journals such as Intelligence and National Security or the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence actually exist. While this is not surprising, it does lead to some common misperceptions about what intelligence agencies are like and what they do. It leads to a romanticization of the role of the single heroic individual dealing with a single danger or event. It also leads to a perception that most of the activities of intelligence agencies relate to human intelligence or human intelligence activities, often referred to as HUMINT, as opposed to signals intelligence or SIGINT. Moreover, it leads to the perception that each nation state has only one or two intelligence agencies. Finally, it leads to a perception that virtually all activities undertaken are active ones aimed at an external enemy. The role of counterintelligence is usually very much downplayed because it's far less easy to dramatize or to romanticize. In fact, intelligence agencies are really bureaucracies, and indeed often very large bureaucracies where there's relatively little room for the James Bond type. Moreover, they are bureaucracies that concentrate upon signals intelligence, not human intelligence, especially in terms of dollars expended. In addition, each nation usually does not have just one or two intelligence agencies, but a whole network of such agencies. Moreover, intelligence agencies are bureaucratic units that are increasingly integral parts of the overall policy-making processes of their respective countries. Their greatest effect is usually on a policy rather than on a single dramatic event, although these do, of course, occasionally still happen. In fact, Canada has been part of a general trend that has seen the institutionalization of intelligence agencies as key parts of the general policy-making process. It hasn't reached quite the same level in Canada as elsewhere, but the trend is very much the same. Canada's intelligence agencies, including CSIS, a part of a network of Western intelligence agencies that have experienced very rapid and significant growth since the end of the Second World War. Not only have these agencies grown, they've also become significant agencies of government in and of their own right. They have large staffs, massive resources, especially in the signals intelligence field, and a high degree of autonomy, which is made all the greater by their anonymity or secrecy. The trend is most noticeable in the United States, where the intelligence agencies have become very many and large. However, it's also clearly discernible in the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Australia, and Canada. The Western intelligence agencies have become institutionalized as the result of a wide variety of factors. The most important factor was the Cold War, and of course the lineup of the world into clear blocks. Not only were the Western intelligence agencies important within their own nations, as CSIS is within Canada, but they were part of an extensive and closely linked worldwide system of intelligence collection and analysis. A related factor has been that the Western powers had to invest heavily in secret intelligence collection, as the bloc opposed to them was very secretive. Another factor was the rapid advance of the technological capabilities for gathering secret intelligence in the form of satellites, computers, and the like. And this trend very rapidly led to the ascendancy of SIGINT agencies around the world in terms of budgets, staffing, and very often political influence. With the end of the Cold War, Canada and the Western powers were left with intelligence agencies that are now pervasive institutions of the nation state. They're global in their reach, and they're very close to the decision-making centers of their home states. They're also huge data collection agencies, and they have very large budgets. Now, it's generally been assumed that with the end of the Cold War, there will be a peace dividend, a part of which will be a sharp reduction in the size of Western intelligence agencies, including Canada's. While some reduction in size is to be expected, it may well not be very large. However, before seeing why that may be the case, I shall say more about the nature of the linkage between intelligence and policy, and then more about the nature of Canada's intelligence network. The policy-making process is complex, with many stages, and thus many potential points of linkage with secret intelligence. In intelligence circles, there's long been a notion that there is a cycle of to intelligence-policy interaction. While the idea is something of a simplification, it does provide a set of categories which provide a useful basis for discussion. The concept of an intelligence cycle can especially be found in many American works and in CIA publications. While they all differ, the key elements are much the same, and the in value, the identification of intelligence requirements, the tasking of appropriate collection agency, the collection of intelligence, the analysis of what has been gathered, the dissemination of the analysis and the use made of the analysis, following which, and to complete the cycle, there is the feedback from the users, which may then change the identification of intelligence requirements. Obviously, in terms of the identification of intelligence requirements, the right types of material have to be acquired. That is, they have to be relevant to the types of decisions that are being made. Much political, economic, and even military intelligence is in fact not secret intelligence. A great deal can be gathered from open sources via diplomatic missions, commercial services, and other ordinary means. A great deal of other intelligence may not be secret, but come from confidential sources, often diplomatic ones. Thus, secret intelligence is likely to form only a small portion of the intelligence being applied to any particular policy issue. Clearly, the secret intelligence should dovetail with, supplement, or confirm non-secret collection so that they both contribute to a common purpose. In terms of tasking, it's clear that the most policy-relevant secret intelligence is likely to result if the policy makers, those who presumably identify the material to be collected, are the ones who do the tasking. The linkage to policy is likely to be more distant if it is not clear to the collectors just what the policy lines are that need to be served. It's also the case that it helps if there's no rivalry between the intelligence agencies or overlap of effort. Well, of course, as we've seen in Canada, there's been quite a lot of rivalry and overlap. Furthermore, there are the normal requirements placed upon any secret intelligence agency that it collects accurate and timely material from reliable sources. Any raw secret intelligence has to go through a process of analysis before it's sent out to the users or the consumers of intelligence. It has to be compared with other secret intelligence and placed in the context of what might often be a mass of open source information on the same general subject. Ideally, this analysis should be done by people and agencies other than those responsible for the collection, because the latter might bring a variety of their own biases to their view of its import and people other than those who will use it, because they rarely have the time to read all the secret and open source material that would need to be read to come to a proper conclusion. Moreover, the users may also well have their own biases and disregard secret intelligence which does not confirm these biases. In short, raw intelligence has to be collated properly, as it often comes from a variety of agencies, not just one, and has to be analyzed properly. Secret intelligence, once properly analyzed, also has to be properly distributed. If it's not distributed to the correct people, it can hardly be said to be of any relevance to the policy-making process. Deciding upon the extent of the distribution is not an easy task, for it clearly should not be too narrow, or the value of secret intelligence will not be known or utilized widely enough to be of much use, and it clearly should not be so broad as to endanger its secret nature. A related aspect of dissemination is that the form in which it's disseminated has to be such that it's easily and quickly digestible, and yet does not oversimplify to the point of error. Once properly disseminated, another precondition of secret intelligence, being significant in the policy process anyway, is that it's relevant and useful to the users or the consumers. It must provide some added value to open source information, even if it's only confirmatory, so that it makes a real contribution to either the policymaker's understanding of an issue or his or her ability to make a particular decision. Finally, another precondition of there being a close link between secret intelligence and policy is that there is a system of feedback built into the intelligence system. This is primarily to ensure that what the users receive is what they need or want, is timely, and it's in the appropriate form. If there's no system of feedback, the danger of secret intelligence being of little or no use is obviously increased. All of these preconditions for secret intelligence to be relevant to policymakers tends to imply that somewhere there should be an agency, group, or person that has the responsibility for coordinating and making sure that all of the above stages in the cycle take place. In some nations, including Canada, it's not at all clear that there is such a body that deals systematically with the totality of the process. This is clearly problematic, for if any of the stages in the cycle don't work well, then the policy relevance of secret intelligence is called into question. With this in mind, I turn now to a description of the component parts of the Canadian intelligence network. And the best known component, of course, of that network is the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS. This was formed in 1984. It reports to the Solicitor General, and it was formed as a consequence of the difficulties that the RCMP Security Service got involved in relation largely to the separatist movement in Quebec in the late 60s and early 70s. A civilianized intelligence service was one of the recommendations of the MacDonald Commission of Inquiry that looked into the allegations against the RCMPSS. CSIS is mandated to collect and analyze information and intelligence respecting activities that may, on reasonable grounds, be suspected of constituting threats to the security of Canada. CSIS has two major operational branches, one for counterterrorism and the other for counterintelligence. It also has an analysis and production branch, which draws on information from the operational branches and from other covert and open intelligence sources to produce intelligence for use in many parts of the government. CSIS is also responsible for the security screening of public servants and others who have access to sensitive information. Thus, CSIS is mandated as a counterintelligence agency, and its equivalent are not the British MI6, or the American Central Intelligence Agency, or the Australian Secret Intelligence Service. Canada has no equivalent of these foreign collection agencies. The functional equivalents of CSIS are the British MI5, the American FBI, at least the counterintelligence part of the FBI's mandate, and the Australian Secret Intelligence Organization, ASIO.
In the fiscal year 93-94, CSIS had a budget of 229 million and a staff of 2,465. This incidentally was down from 2,760 the previous year. It's also just acquired a brand new $151 million headquarters in Ottawa to replace eight old buildings. That $151 million, by the way, is more than it cost to build the University of Northern British Columbia. Two other agencies that are part of the Canadian intelligence network report to the Minister of National Defence. And it's these agencies that we tend to hear very little about. One of them is the Communications Security Establishment, or CSE, and the other is the Defence Intelligence Units under the Chief of Intelligence and Security in DND. The Communications Security Establishment is Canada's Signals, or SIGINT, agency. Its role is comparable to Britain's GCHQ, America's NSA, and Australia's Defence Signals Directorate. It has five divisions, which to some degree reveal what it does, namely SIGINT production, policy and plans, technology, and InfoSec, information security, and of course administration. While very little has ever been publicly revealed about CSE, it's thought to have a staff of over 1,000 and a very large budget reflecting the technical nature of its work. The number of its employees is less than for CSIS, but the budget is many times higher. The precise mandate of the CSE is secret, but it is implicit in its title and structure, I guess, while statements by ministers and newspapers indicate that its role is extensive. Mind you, those statements have only come about in the past few years, until about 5 or 6 years ago. Ministers usually denied that the establishment even existed. It's clear that CSE monitors the radio and other electronic signals of a number of foreign nations. It apparently also eavesdrops on some foreign embassies, as well as some consulates and trade missions across the country. It also has responsibility for protecting government secrets and communications. The term defense intelligence is applied to the five directorates under the command of the Chief of Intelligence and Security in the Department of National Defense. These are defense intelligence, geographic operations, imagery exploitation, scientific and technical intelligence, and intelligence plans and doctrines. Some of these directorates collect secret intelligence, and they also openly collect information from military attachés and military establishments abroad, as well as, of course, by contact with the armed services of friendly nations. It should be noted that the Department of National Defense is also mandated to help resolve terrorist incidents and report and to support the RCMP CERT team. Another part of the Canadian intelligence network resides within the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, where there is a Director General in charge of what is called the Security and Intelligence Bureau. Within this bureau, there are three divisions with security and intelligence-related functions. These are the Foreign Intelligence Division, the Operations and Intelligence Center, and the Security Division. The first two are collection and dissemination units. The last named division has the lead role in managing the government's response to terrorist activity involving Canadians, Canadian diplomatic missions, and Canadian interests abroad. This division is also responsible for the security and safety of the department's personnel and property, both in Ottawa and in foreign nations. There are also other important parts of the Canadian intelligence network. These include the units that report to the Director General of Security and Emergency Planning within the Department of Transport. Another part of the network is the Department of Citizenship and Immigration, which has a control and intelligence unit within the Immigration Enforcement Branch. The customs side of Revenue Canada is concerned with narco-terrorism and the illegal export of defense-related goods and technologies. It has an intelligence services unit within the Enforcement Directorate, which produces tactical intelligence for use in the field and strategic intelligence for the use of senior management in planning. So as you can see, there are quite a lot of units. The central body, though, intended to integrate the various pieces of this intelligence network and make the intelligence cycle referred to earlier work properly, is the Security and Intelligence Division within the Privy Council Office. It has a Security and Intelligence Branch, an Assessment Secretariat, and a Legislation and House Planning Unit as well. The Assessment Secretariat was created just before the 1993 election, quote, in an effort to streamline Canada's overall assessment process, to increase the cohesion and cooperation of the whole intelligence community, and to redefine the way in which the intelligence product was marketed. The Intelligence Advisory Committee is the core of the Privy Council system, and it directs the work of both an interdepartmental coordinating committee, which advises on intelligence requirements and dissemination methods, and what are called the interdepartmental experts groups, which coordinate the production of central assessments as well as assessments of foreign economic and political issues that were previously produced in the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. Now, just from this partial description of the agencies involved in intelligence activities in Canada, you can see that the concentration upon CSIS and its activities, which is common in the media, is misleading. It conceals the fact that there is an extensive network of agencies scattered throughout the bureaucracy in Ottawa and indeed throughout the country. So what will happen to the Canadian intelligence network just described in outline now that the Cold War is over? The most likely scenario is that there will be some shrinkage in budgets and staff in some of the agencies, such as CSIS, but even this is not likely to be as great as many would expect. In fact, the shrinkage will probably be more or less in line with general cutbacks associated with hard times. In short, it's most unlikely, in my view, that there will be a peace dividend. However, there will be a major reorientation. There will be little shrinkage in budgets and staff for two reasons, namely bureaucratic niche defense and the existence of real threats beside that of the Cold War. There'll be an reorientation because of the realization that a wide range of threats will continue despite the ending of the Cold War, and that other threats exist that have not been given due attention because of the focus on Cold War threats. As David Boren, the chairman of the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, has said, it's clear that as the world becomes multipolar, more complex and no longer understandable through the prism of Soviet competition, more intelligence, not less, will be needed. By bureaucratic niche defense, I mean the tendency for any agency to find new work for itself when some of its current work disappears. CSIS and the other agencies are unlikely to be immune from this. About 2 years ago, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, SIRC, asked Mr. Raymond Protti, then the director of CSIS, to prepare a report on the role for CSIS in the post-Cold War world. While the full details of the report are not known, Mr. Protti did speak to a House of Commons committee and state that CSIS was becoming more involved in trying to prevent economic espionage, which it said was on the rise. The opposition, a liberal critic for the Solicitor General's Department at the time, Mr. Tom Wappell, said that it seems to me CSIS, is an agency looking for a job. Whether or not that's the case, there is regrettably a job to be done in this area, and it's getting larger. As Mr. Protti reported, there are now a couple of dozen nations whose intelligence agencies are used for purposes of economic espionage and which target Canadian institutions. Unfortunately, economic espionage is only one of the very real threats to Canada which are on the rise. Therefore, it's likely that the Canadian intelligence network will have more than enough to do, even though the Cold War has ended. The use of the term Cold War masked the fact that there was little peace in the world, and that the Cold War was itself made up of a series of mini-wars. Many of these mini-wars didn't end with the end of the Cold War, and the end of the Cold War sparked some new wars, especially between and within many of the former Soviet republics. It should also not be forgotten that well before the end of the Cold War, the intelligence agencies had had to significantly reorient themselves to combat terrorism, most of which was not Soviet or Cold War related. Other non-Cold War threats were also on the rise well before the end of the Cold War, including economic espionage, drug trafficking, migration, environmental and health issues. And I'll briefly review some of these newer and growing threats and the role change that they imply. However, before doing so, it should be noted that another aspect of the likely future of the Canadian intelligence network is that it will slowly but surely disengage itself from the very close links that it has had with the other Western agencies. Those close linkages were a direct result of a common and serious threat. With the disappearance of that threat, the end of the Cold War, the natural rivalries that exist, even among close allies, are likely to come to the fore. The pressures of self-interest and especially economic competition will inevitably lead to some splintering of the former alliance, and indeed that is already beginning to happen. The matter of friendly intelligence agencies spying on each other's nations has hit the headlines several times recently, and it's been the subject of several recent books, for example, Peter Schweitzer's Friendly Spies. In any event, the intelligence agencies found it hard enough to cooperate even in the face of a formidable enemy during the Cold War. They were always worried, quite correctly, that cooperation increased the danger of their sources and methods being compromised. That the Canadian intelligence network is likely to be kept busy even in the post-Cold War period becomes readily apparent when the various new and emerging threats that are faced by them are detailed. These new and emerging threats range from proliferation in regional conflicts, the emergence of China as a major power, the changing nature of international terrorism, a growth in economic espionage, the increasing dangers of the proliferation of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, increased drug trafficking, and the emergence of environmental and health issues as national security issues. But before discussing these newer threats, it's at least worth briefly noting that even though the Soviet Union has disappeared, Russia is not all that stable a nation. Strong forces of reaction within do exist, and it has a very strong nuclear capability. So as Robert Gates, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, said, there are still those who want to know what the 14th Army is doing in Moldova. Similarly, Canada would be well advised to maintain its alliance-related capability to observe developments in Russia. Excuse me a moment, I just got some water. Regional conflicts or potential conflicts have arisen or re-emerged since the end of the Cold War that make one wonder if the world is now safer, as so many seem to believe. Some might well think that it's a more dangerous place to which greater and more varied resources should be brought to bear. The recent disputes between Russia and the Ukraine over the ownership of the Black Sea Fleet, the control of Ukrainian nuclear weapons and over Crimea have caused great concern. And it's perhaps scary to recall that a recent Deputy Supreme Commander of NATO's scenario for the outbreak of the Third World War was not a direct nuclear exchange between the East and West, but mistakes made following a nuclear exchange between Russia and an unnamed breakaway republic. And just recently, North Korea moved nearly 1 million troops to the frontier with South Korea in response to a United Nations and American desire to inspect suspected nuclear weapons facilities in that country. At the time, Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State, more than once stated that he hoped a preemptive strike to cripple North Korea's nuclear capability might not be necessary. It's also likely that one regional power, China, may be revealed to be a much bigger threat than was previously thought. If its economy keeps on growing at the present rate, the projections are that it will not be too long before China has a bigger economy than does America, and therefore it may even emerge as a world power to rival the United States. It has certainly been argued that the Cold War led to such a concentration of attention on the Warsaw Pact nations that it diverted attention away from China and that it distorted the allocation of Western intelligence resources such that it, quote, allowed the Chinese espionage apparatus to operate outside the focus of mainstream counterintelligence concerns. One author has argued that as a result, the United States and Canada are very badly prepared to protect their national assets against Beijing's espionage efforts. In fact, he argues that, quote, China's intelligence gathering operations have increased to the point where agencies with counterintelligence responsibilities are overwhelmed by the sheer number of cases. Terrorism has had an ugly presence in Canada in recent decades, and Canada has seen in the Air India bombing one of the worst terrorist attacks ever made. And while terrorism has been on the wane for the past few years in Canada, it could very easily flare up again. North America has generally been free of such incidents, but the World Trade Center bombing is a warning of what might come. We grow falsely assured terrorism only happens elsewhere. It does not. I've twice been in London when IRA bombs went off nearby. I've been in Jerusalem when a hand grenade was placed on the bus behind mine. And I've been in Durban and Cape Town when bombs went off. However, the closest I got to being hurt by bombs was actually in Montreal, in the Queen's Printer bookstore on St. Catherine Street, in Eaton's, in the Place Bonaventure, and at McGill University. Thus, I know from personal experience that not only can it happen here, but it does happen here. The general trends in international terrorism to which CSIS and others have to react are a growth in ethnic nationalism, a growth in religious extremism in many areas, continued state sponsorship of terrorism, and increasing sophistication in terrorist methods and equipment. Also, Canada's history indicates that it's worth a watching brief in case there's the reemergence of homegrown terrorism associated with separatism or eco-terrorism, animal rights terrorism, and the like. Economic espionage is growing in frequency and seriousness, and it's incorrect to think that it's a phenomenon of the post-Cold War world. There's more of it now, but there was lots of it then, and it's rapidly increasing. More than 24 intelligence agencies around the world operate in the area of industrial espionage, or economic espionage, I should say. These include China, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, Taiwan, South Korea, Israel, and many others. Some of them, even the supposedly friendly ones, do target Canada. And the Cold War tended to mask what was known in this area. I guess the book and the film entitled Rising Sun hints at the strength of Japan's activities in this field. However, it was known for years before the appearance of the book or the film that the Kempai Tai, the Japanese Secret Service, has long had a far broader and more imaginative concept of intelligence than virtually any other power. Of all people in the world, few rival the Japanese in the desire for knowledge for its own sake. And as in all aspects of life, this has been the basis of the Japanese secret services thinking. And there's little distinction made between political, economic, and social intelligence. Virtually all Japanese abroad in some manner funnel information back that eventually reaches the Kempai Tai. We should be encouraged by the fact that CSIS, in response to this type of threat, recently established in June 1991, to be precise, a technology transfer unit that analyzes proliferation and technology transfer issues, and which has established an active liaison program with the private sector in Canada. Most analysts think that the Canadian intelligence agencies and Western agencies in general will have a legitimate and increasingly important role in monitoring and combating the proliferation of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons capabilities. Recently, the FBI director called the growing trend to the smuggling of nuclear materials the greatest threat to the United States since the end of the Cold War. This is not only because some of the likely buyers are regimes like those in Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and Syria, but also because some of the potential buyers are likely to be terrorist groups. In the United Kingdom, the government has reached agreement with university authorities on which students ought not to be admitted for high-level scientific research. The fear is not related to students from certain countries gaining access to nuclear know-how, but their concern for them gaining access to biological weapons know-how. There's a growing recognition of the profound danger now posed by the proliferation of these biological weapons. After all, a 12-kiloton nuclear weapon exploded over a city will kill perhaps 80,000 people. But a biological weapon consisting of 100 kilograms of anthrax spores could kill between 1 and 3 million people. The problem is great because a biotechnology revolution is underway, and because biotechnology is relatively cheap and simple to master, and is conducted by a large number of small companies that are not easily controlled. Many nations have also dragged their intelligence agencies into the fight against drug trafficking. Many of the agencies have not been very eager to get into the field, partly because it's not seen as quite appropriate for an espionage agency. It's also partly because some see the war against drugs as ill-advised, very difficult to mount, and probably unwinnable. However, such agencies have some very useful assets that can be used in that war. And little is known about whether or not many branches of the Canadian intelligence network have a significant role in this area, but the pressure upon them to do so is probably very strong if they currently do not. Intelligence agencies have also become involved in analyses of other threats to national security that are not normally thought of as being within their ambit, but which need to be analyzed by some agency. An example is the emergence of environmental issues as security issues. This is because environmental issues are increasingly important as factors underlying border conflicts, cultural and racial clashes, war, and other forms of strife. They also have potential for creating stresses which make societies ungovernable and threaten the political and physical viability of many communities. Another of the more interesting examples are the studies being conducted by some American agencies on the impact of the AIDS pandemic. The imminent and near total economic and social collapse of some nations in Africa as a consequence of that pandemic are an awfully foreboding warning of what might come to us in the not too distant future if we aren't very careful. There are already parts of Kenya where the working adult population has virtually completely died off, leaving only the very young and the very old. As with environmental forces, the AIDS pandemic could become in time a very significant destabilizing force in the world with very serious consequences for Canada. So these new threats mean that life has become more complicated, not simpler, with the end of the Cold War. With the loss of the Soviet paradigm, most of these other security issues have not been newly discovered. They've just moved up in relative priority. There's a broader spectrum of issues to be faced, and there's a shift away not just from the Soviet paradigm, but also from a focus on largely military threats. This means that not only are the resources likely to be stretched thinly over a wider variety of issues, but there needs to be more sophisticated and more integrated analysis, as well as greater flexibility in planning. Given these new threats, the question is, how has the Canadian intelligence network responded? The answer is that we don't really know in any detail, because oversight only occurs in relation to one part of the system, to CSIS. It does seem that CSIS has changed. In fact, the 1992-93 report of the Security Intelligence Review Committee, CIRC as it's called, stated that, quote, CSIS is now a very different organization than it was 4 or 5 years ago. Moreover, it goes on to say, we believe that CSIS is reorienting its activities in a sensible, prudent fashion, given current circumstances, and we expect the process to continue steadily over the next few years. Perhaps the clearest indicator of this is that in 1984, when CSIS was created, the combined services dedicated to counterterrorism and counterintelligence functions were distributed in the ratio of 20% to 80% in favor of counterintelligence. The ratio in 1993 was 56% to 44% in favor of counterterrorism. The Security Intelligence Review Committee also reviewed the internal CSIS task force review called for by the Solicitor General and completed in the fall of 1992, that was intended to assess how the security environment might affect the service's mandate over time. CSIRC stated in its 1992-93 report that, quote, "For the most part, we do not differ with many of the basic premises in the CSIS forecast. Chief among our agreements is that terrorism will remain pervasive and violent, and that the intelligence services of several countries will continue to be directed at Canada, in part to obtain defense technology at low cost. However, while we have at least some assurance via CERC that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service has correctly observed these trends and appropriately responded to them, we have no similar assurance about the CSE or the other elements in the Canadian intelligence network that I mentioned before." So where do these two trends lead? They lead in two very opposite results. The darker and more worrying possibility is that with such a sophisticated knowledge-gathering capability, the various elements of the Canadian intelligence network could become tools of an ever more intrusive surveillance state. The brighter, and fortunately perhaps most likely possibility, is that the Canadian intelligence network will increasingly resemble a set of private sector think tanks. The darker scenario could be justified on the grounds of imperatives of economic rather than military security. It is against the ethos of the, fortunately, I think this darker scenario is unlikely to occur. It's against the ethos of the elements of the Canadian intelligence network, and it's not part of the Canadian culture. Moreover, fairly extensive oversight of CSIS takes place. Canada has more checks on CSIS than most other nations do on their equivalent agencies. Apart from legal constraints, there's an Inspector General of CSIS and a Security Intelligence Review Committee, CERC, made up of Privy Councillors that I referred to before. That having been said, it would be very wise to be vigilant and try to ensure that the current situation improves. I say this not just because of the occasional troubling incidents such as the current Grant Bristow affair. It's at least as worrying that while CSIS is evaluated for political, fiscal, and managerial accountability, it seems not to be so for operational effectiveness. It is even more worrying that the other elements in the Canadian intelligence network do not come under anything like the same evaluation procedures that CSIS does. This, in my view, is a serious flaw in the Canadian political and bureaucratic system. It would seem to me to be highly advisable that there be an evaluation of a number of matters that relate to the security and intelligence network as a whole. The identification of intelligence requirements should be evaluated. The manner in which raw intelligence is analyzed should be evaluated. The manner in which secret intelligence is distributed to users or consumers should be evaluated. The degree to which secret intelligence is useful to its users needs to be evaluated. There is currently no formal feedback mechanism from users to producers in the Canadian network, as far as I'm aware. In addition, the degree to which the system is coordinated and serves policy objectives should be subjected to evaluation. In short, it would be advisable to have a thorough investigation of the entire Canadian security and intelligence network and of the interaction between the various component parts. An opportunity was lost when the government made it clear in its 1991 document entitled On Course that it would not launch such an investigation, despite the comments by the Special Parliamentary Committee of the House of Commons the previous year in its report entitled In Flux. I very much agree with Stuart Farson in his recent call for a royal commission to be established to investigate how best the Canadian intelligence network might be reorganized so as of the future. I also think it would be wise to establish a permanent parliamentary committee on security and intelligence, as recommended by the 1989 Senate Commons Committee that reviewed the CSIS Act, and by Dr. Peter Russell, who was the research director for the MacDonald Commission of Inquiry that looked into the RCMP-SS. The brighter and thankfully more likely possibility is that with the end of the Cold War, CSIS and the other elements in the Canadian intelligence network will increasingly resemble think tanks, as Wesley Walker has maintained. After all, it has a lot of information available to it, and it has sophisticated means by which to acquire knowledge. The component parts of the Canadian intelligence network will probably offer a broader range of policy advice to a greater range of government agencies, make greater use of open sources in the manner of a think tank, and themselves become more open to links with other agencies, academia, and the private sector. This is almost inevitable if the agencies do enter the new areas previously mentioned because of their interdisciplinary nature and the availability of significant amounts of open source material and the need to reach a wider range of intelligence consumers. An emphasis on the new areas is likely also to produce personnel changes over time that will again make the agencies increasingly resemble think tanks. Certainly a wider variety of skills will be needed in intelligence agencies. If nothing else, a wider variety of language and area specialists will be required. In addition, there would be in this scenario a closer integration across the entire community, given the complex and interdisciplinary nature of the new topics. There might even be a much greater exchange of personnel across the agencies. Moreover, if a thoroughgoing review were undertaken, new types of agencies might emerge, such as an equivalent of the Australian Office of National Assessments, is more fitted to the new range of work. In any event, whether or not the direction is towards the surveillance state or the think tank, I think we're likely to hear more about the Canadian intelligence network, not less, as one might expect with the end of the Cold War. Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Weller will be pleased to answer questions. If you'll raise your hand, we'll try to single out who...
What about the people that are involved in these things? Do you know any of them? Are they just people like you and me, or who are they?
Yeah, the question was, who are the people involved in all these sorts of things? Are they just like you and me? I guess the answer is basically now, yes. Initially, the membership of CSIS was, of course, largely from the RCMP, but now with much broader recruitment, much wider variety of types of people have come into the service, and I think it's now true to say that more than 50% of them are women. And they and there is an openness now to the system, which is very different. When I attended a Learner Society conference recently, a friend of mine who is an art historian was very curious that I was attending a meeting to do with secret intelligence, and she said, are there spies around here? And I said, yes, there are some, and pointed to a clump of CSIS agents across the way, took her over there and introduced her, and she said to one of them, are you a spy? And he said, yes. The question was, is it known if CSE monitors internet? The answer is it isn't. It isn't known whether it is or not. And I'm sorry, I couldn't catch the second part.
The question concerned intellectual property, copyright, pirated editions. Is that a responsibility of any of the...
No, not of the intelligence agencies, no. Well, I don't think it'll wreck it forever. These sorts of things happen from time to time. It's always notoriously difficult to maintain control of such agents, actually. His tasking was, well, it's not really known exactly what his tasking was, or quite what he was intended to do, but such agents sometimes try to embellish what it is they do to make themselves more useful to the agencies they're serving. They sometimes lose a sense of identification and do indeed sometimes work for the agencies that they're supposed to penetrate rather than for the agencies that task them. And there are all kinds of things like that that occur. As I say, I think that's an isolated incident. It won't, I think, affect the reputation of CSIS in the long term. It does raise the question of, are they undertaking proper targeting? That is more the issue, rather than having a rogue agent. And what exactly are they trying to do in terms of the heritage front? The answer isn't known, but the big question is, why are they targeting that group? Should they be targeting it? Is it an effective use of resources?
Gentlemen at the back.
It hasn't been discussed a great deal in the Canadian context, that's right, but you've hit upon a distinction that needs to be made. Usually that's the distinction, or it's implicit in the distinction between economic and industrial espionage. Intelligence agencies tend to refer to economic intelligence when they mean protecting national assets, rather than industrial espionage, which could be the protecting of a particular firm's information against other firms. But it's very difficult, even in terms of economic espionage, to in fact determine when you are protecting a national asset or in fact aiding a particular company. And then, of course, there is the question, well, should you in fact be protecting things purely economic, or should you only protect those things that could lead to a proliferation of biological or nuclear weapons capability? Is it just that technology that should be watched very carefully? Thanks. The question was, in some of these newer areas that I mentioned, are intelligence agencies the most effective agencies to really deal with them? Should intelligence agencies be touching them at all, in fact? And I think the answer is that's a very good question. And in some of these areas, probably intelligence agencies should not be the ones involved. And I would hope that if the second trend that I mentioned comes about, that we have a development of think tanks, that these think tanks would perhaps even be indeed the private sector ones that deal with some of these issues, or agencies that are not secret intelligence agencies in the form that we've known them before, but may get some bits of their information from agencies that mainly concentrate upon terrorism, the proliferation of nuclear biological weapons technology, or look at real threats in a military sense. So maybe these newer jobs should be done by other types of agencies, yes. And hopefully, if there was a proper review of the Canadian Intelligence Network, if there was a Royal Commission of Inquiry, this might be one of the things that would come out of it and be recommended.
Gentlemen over here.
You indicated that the CSE reports to the Department of National Defense. Is it still principally armed forces personnel, or is it now half and half military civilians?
I don't know. The rumor has it that it's moving away from the military in terms of fairly strongly civilian, but the answer is I don't know.
Yes?
Yes, I'm interested in getting some more information about what
Well, the most recent one is a book by Nicholas. The question was, what is known about China's activities and what's the most recent publication dealing with this? The most recent one is by a man called Nicholas Eftimiades, former Central Intelligence analyst, called China's Intelligence Services.
Gentleman in the middle there.
As a result of the AIMS affair with the CIA, there seems to be some question raised at least by American senators that the CIA is not a very effective operation. Do you think it's best to contest the contact with the Canadian service, or is that not?
I didn't catch the last bit, sorry. The Central Intelligence, well, it's always a problem with intelligence agencies is that you hear of their failures and you usually don't hear of their successes. So it's very difficult to make an assessment of how useful they are. Certainly, Senator Moynihan has argued that the Central Intelligence Agency of late has made so many mistakes and got so many things wrong that it should be done away with. That's only partially correct. A lot of what the Central Intelligence Agency has produced in recent years has been right on. The great arguments about the extent of battle damage in the Gulf War as a result of the air raids that it so infuriated General Schwarzkopf, or the Central Intelligence Agency estimates that so infuriated General Schwarzkopf, in fact, turned out to be correct. They argued that the amount of battle damage was much lower than the military agencies were saying, and that was so. Many of the CIA estimates in the Vietnam War were much more accurate than the military intelligence estimates. And it's often very useful to have an agency that is not directly tied to the consumer, i.e., in this case, the defense establishment producing estimates, because so often agencies tied to defense want to produce those things that are liked or that people want to hear. And it's sometimes a measure of the success of an agency that it says things that people don't want to hear. In terms of the Canadian situation, it's a bit different. CSIS is, of course, a counterintelligence agency, whereas the CIA is not. And in counterintelligence, it's even more difficult to know when successes have occurred. They have some information about a few, but by and large, you don't know about them. And after all, in the Commonwealth Games or the Winter Olympics in Calgary, it is known that there were threats and they were averted. That is a success, but most people don't think of that as being anything much or particularly useful, but believe me, if something had happened, we would have heard a lot about it.
Perhaps you have time for two more questions.
Talking about the new threat we face today, as you mentioned, China, since the Cold War, is there more communication with the Russians, who certainly would have some experience?
Repeat. The question is, with the end of the Cold War, is there more connection between the Western intelligence agencies and the Russian concerning the potential Chinese threat? Again, the answer is yes, to some extent, but I really don't know the details of it. But it's very clear that some of the East Bloc services and Western services have been exchanging information on what they now regard as common threats. Well, I guess they always regarded that as a common threat, but now they can actually do something about it.
Last question.
I think this gentleman, you did ask one earlier. Gentleman here?
It seems to me, looking back upon the Cold War days, that there was a defined system and something that one seemed to be able to comprehend much more readily than the present situation which is more akin to biological warfare than mental warfare. It seems to me that although the Cold War may be over, the war which we might encounter eventually might be far more hard to control with counterintelligence activities than the Cold War was during the past period.
I think that's a very true comment. The comment was that the situation that we see in the post-Cold War world is much more complicated and maybe far more difficult to control than it was in the Cold War. It's very true. The Cold War, in very many ways, was a very simple situation, very easily understood. Targeting was very direct. And unfortunately, I think the Cold War, as I said, misled a lot of Western intelligence agencies into over-concentrating on the Soviet threat, so that many of these other threats, which now appear as newly emerged ones, really weren't. They were just hidden.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the Vice President Academic, Dan Birch, to thank our speaker.
I've forgotten the microphone. Strangled is departing.
When Professor Cairns introduced our speaker this evening, he noted that being a political scientist was particularly appropriate preparation, both for the subject of his studies and for his work as a university president. Reminded me of the observation of another university president, Woodrow Wilson, who said that he spent the first half of his career learning politics among the professionals at Princeton, and the second half of it practicing politics among the amateurs in Washington. I think we have a variant on that tonight. President Weller not only practices among the students of politics in the university, but he obviously turns his astute mind to the study of politics among the amateurs in the intelligence services. There's another famous dictum, of course, that of C.P. Snow, who observed that the reason that the conflicts in academe are so intense is that the stakes are so small. And Professor Weller has reminded us this evening that indeed in this world of mutual vulnerability with tremendous emerging issues of terrorism, migration, that have no respect for international borders, that the stakes are indeed very large, and it behooves us to study, to understand, and to act in defense of the freedom that we enjoy so much. Professor Weller, on behalf of the gathering this evening, I want to once again welcome you to the community of scholars in British Columbia, tell you how much we appreciate you as a colleague among the leaders in academe in this province, and how much we've appreciated your lecture this evening. Thank you very much.